Well, good evening again, and a greeting in Jesus' name. It's good to be here with you and to consider further the implications of a foundation. For sure, without foundation, men get, no morals at all. Boy, you can end up all kinds of places, as was brought out in the devotional. I'm glad to have my wife and Nathaniel here tonight with us. Thank God that they came safely. Well, I want to continue on with the idea of foundations, as I've said, and I told you last night I was going to ask the question tonight by way of the title of the message: Are we really non-resistant? Are we really non-resistant? And non-resistance has been a foundational principle, one of the two that often you will find historically written down as a tremendously important to our worldview, non-resistance and non-conformity being the other one. And often it is said, if you lose one, you lose the other. And I too believe that it is tremendously important, the worldview that includes non-resistance. And are we really? Are we really what we ought to be when it comes this? No, we say we are, and I'm planning to be director at a CAS project later this spring, and this is where we are attempting to get set up so that in the event of a draft, our young men can serve under one of our projects and not have to go to some hospital and nursing home or elsewhere and lose out. And the point being is that we expect that in the event of a military draft, our young men would be conscientious objectors, conscientiously opposed to serving in the military and taking someone's life and fighting, yes, even in defense of this country. And so that's kind of the thing our mind goes to when we hear the word non-resistance. We don't fight. We're one of the historical peace churches. And our government has graciously allowed us to be conscientious objectors. And it was not always so here. And there's some interesting stories about early on in this nation how our people suffered for their conscientiously taking a stand against serving in the military. And I just want to be real honest with you tonight. This message is one that is hard for me. It's hard for me. It's hard for me to be what I ought to be when it comes to being a non-resistant person. Because I believe on the scale of when it matters, non-resistance in time of military or conflict of our nation really ought to be in the minority of times that it matters. Because non-resistance permeates the life of a true follower of God, and it is an everyday occurrence. And I think I will say this at the end, but if our non-resistance is only good in the time of military conflict, then it's no good. It's no good. It doesn't do what it ought to do. I'd like to begin with turning to Isaiah chapter 53 here, and what a strange place to begin a talk on non-resistance. And I just am so impressed here with Jesus, and this was in prophecy. Who hath believed our report, and to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? For he shall grow up out before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of the dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray, we have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed, and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shears is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. For the transgression of my people was he stricken. And he made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, because he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. He shall see of the travail of his soul, and shall be satisfied. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he hath poured out his soul unto death. And he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bare the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors. And we see here a picture of Jesus in prophecy and all these things that he did and his willingness to suffer and his focus on the good of others and his quietness in oppression. He just didn't have to, he didn't have much to say. I was impressed too with that idea of he poured out his soul unto death. Willingness to suffer. The good of others. Quietness and oppression. Poured out his soul unto death. And, you know, we could turn then to when this all came true. And Jesus there before his judges and the crown of thorns and the mocking. The false accusations and the cruelty and the spitting on him and the slapping him. And say, hey, you Messiah, tell us who did that. It's Jesus as he followed through on this prophecy. And in those ideas of Jesus, a willingness to suffer, a do what I do for the good of others, a quietness in oppression, and to pour out your soul unto death. You know, you see that that's far beyond a military engagement where you simply refuse to take up arms. You know, Scripture tells us that in the end times there shall be wars and rumors of wars, and anybody that follows the news can see that that is how it is. And we do well to remember that very shortly and with stunning speed, times can change. And we could again be faced with the military side of our non-resistance. What happens then? What happens when our neighbors are fighting and dying? And their sons aren't coming home except in a box. And they see you there. And they see your special treatment by the government that says, yes, these people can take a conscientious stand against military involvement. And then these neighbors, they watch your life, see. Not from that time on. You know, they reel back. And what's it been like here for the last 20 years? And will your neighbors appreciate the consistency of being conscientiously opposed in time of conflict? Because they have seen that in your life, the rest of your life, the vast majority of your life, you really are non-resistant. Is that what they see? We could read the teaching there from Matthew chapter 5, if you want to turn to that, verses 38 to 48. And so we see what Jesus did, and we see what he taught here. He says this, "You've heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. If any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee turn not thou away. Thou hast heard that it hath been said, Thou shalt love thy neighbor, and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven, for he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if you salute your brethren only, what do you more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect." And we see the teaching here, and our people, the Anabaptist, have attempted to live this out. And we see kind of the two aspects of non-resistance here. One being the don't fight back, the defenselessness. The defenselessness. The turn the other cheek. If he hits you, you turn the other cheek. If he sues you and takes away your coat, let him have your cloak too. And the give and the borrow. And if he makes you go a mile, go with him twain. And so we see the refusal to fight back and to hit back and to even the score. And so that's one leg of non-resistance. And the other side is to actively pursue reconciliation and the success of your enemy. Actively, proactively. I will do you good when you've done me wrong. Love your enemies, and love not being some affection or warm feeling. Love being action, and I will do good to you when you were mean to me. And when you curse me, I will bless you. And when they despitefully used you and persecuted you, I will pray for you. I'll pray for you. And so we see in there the active, do good side to non-resistance. It goes far beyond just a refusal to fight. And we see that so incredibly modeled by Christ. And they were mean to him. And Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And the ones that bruised him, he was bruised for their iniquities. And all those things that they brought against him, he suffered for their good. I will do it for you, though you were mean to me. And we see and we have a rich heritage of this kind of behavior. And this is just a side note. I have heard the last couple of years a number of times someone make this statement to this effect: we need to be more than Anabaptists. More than. And I think I understand the burden of that we really need to do what God wants us to do. We need to go back to the New Testament. We understand we can't just lean on our heritage and just be glad and that's all good enough. But, you know, when I think of non-resistance and what the Anabaptists have managed to get done, you know, to say that I'm going to be more than an Anabaptist. You know, that's a tall order. Read your history. Read your history. And to think of your loved ones burned at the stake, and your goods taken away, and you be chased from one place to another, and worship in a cave, and encouraging your young child to, yes, stand on your way there to watch his execution. And then to bless your persecutors and to pray for them which despitefully use you. You're gonna be more than that. That's a close walk with God. Well, we could ask ourselves a number of questions in relation to this idea. Are we really non-resistant? Are we? What would our neighbors say? And the first question I have here is, does your speech betray you? And you recognize the words there from the Peter at the trial of Jesus, and that young lady, you know, she saw him, and there was Peter. You know, he was. It was kind of hard to hide Peter in life, right? Because just Peter was just there, and if you saw Jesus and his disciples, you could be sure that Peter was part of what you saw. And this young lady here, they saw, and she was there, and the trial was going on, and Jesus was on trial, and they didn't know how this was all going to turn out. And they came to him, and this lady said, you know, I saw you with Jesus. No, I wasn't there. And another maid saw him there and said, you know, that guy, he was with Jesus. Peter said, no. And then the others standing by there, they told him, you know, your speech betrays you. Even if we hadn't saw you, you know the story of Peter, but his speech betrayed him, and it betrayed that, yes, he had been with Jesus, and yes, he was one of those guys from out of town. And the question is, does your speech betray your non-resistance? Is that what comes out when you talk? And you get together and you read the news, who was it? Paul Ryan, one of those politicians. You know, we ought to go to just make the desert just glow in the dark. ISIS, see. And your neighbor told you that, and what did you say? And did your speech indicate that you were ready to suffer? You were ready to do good to those poor, deceived Muslim individuals who had it so wrong what life was all about, and who God was. And what did you say? And did your speech betray you? And you were on your way to town, and it's a busy day, and for me they all are. All those days are busy. And you're late. It's hard not to be late. And you know, and that guy cuts you off in traffic. and that two-lane road, and there was no passing zone, and you were just late. And what did you say? And did your words indicate a value to this person? Did your driving remind him that, you know, he mattered? And when you got to the end of the day, that interaction with this man in a real situation in life was more important to you than getting the job done and then not being late. And how was it? And when he shows up and he's on the draft board, see? And then he's going to ask you questions about this conscientious opposition to being fighty. What do you say? And are you really non-resistant? Ephesians 6:9 says, "And you must do the same things unto them, forbearing threatening." What about that? Forbearing threatening. And is that what our children know us as? Where's dad threatening? "And if you don't, then I will." And a life of threatening. I can see this is going to take a while tonight. I'll try to hurry through it. Joe, I have already preached for almost 2 hours, so you may not want to give me that liberty. And how do we know if we're that non-resistant? How do we know? And we could ask ourselves, is there a quietness to our spirit? Is there quietness? And we could turn to Luke 9 there, where James and John saw that rejection of Jesus by the Samaritans. And right away, you know, they just wanted to call down fire and just smoke this place because of what they're doing to you, Jesus. And Jesus said, "You know not what spirit you're of." You know where that came from? "For the Son of Man has not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." And so, the wrong there. And what comes out of our spirit when we've been wronged? What comes out? Peter tells us, you know, "It is thankworthy if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully." And at least James and John there had the moral high ground that they were taking a stand because people were being mean to Jesus. But how is it with us? And is that quietness? And I was just so impressed when I thought of Jesus, the lamb. And he was dumb. And he just was quiet. And he faced all of those things, and it came against him. And there was just a quietness. And how is it with us? And how is it when the wrong comes to us from someone inside the walls here? And no, it wasn't nice, and it wasn't kind. And you know, we get in the car with our wife after the service or after the men's meeting, and decisions have been made, and things were said, and it wasn't fair, and it wasn't right, and it wasn't what I meant. And what's the spirit there in the car? And did we portray when you know those leaders got it all wrong? Did we portray then a willingness to suffer for the good of the next man? Did we portray a quietness that said that, yeah, I'll take it this time for their good? Is that what came through on your way home from church, from the men's meeting? Are we really non-resistant? What about in political matters? Do your political views match your professed stand of non-resistance? Do they? Is that what you have expressed in this community? Has it been consistent with your profession? You know, it would be interesting for me to go down here to the local farm and ranch supply or some local building supply house that sells all you contractors your stuff. And I just walk in there and say, hey, you know those men down there at the Strawberry Mennonite Church? What do they think of Mr. Obama? What's their stand on Mrs. Clinton? And well, what would they tell me? You know, I don't really know. But in a rural, conservative county of the South, I can about guess what your neighbors stand for. And does your involvement, the way you've talked, the way you've expressed yourself, lend itself to a Anabaptist position of pray, pay, and obey? Is that what you told them that we ought to do? Is that what you said? Or have you managed to be more than that somehow? Are you walking close to Jesus? I'd ask a question here too. Is there a detachment from the military strength of your nation? Do you find yourself using the word "are"? Our planes and our aircraft carriers and our stuff. Are you an ambassador just passing through? Or is this your stuff? And it's our troops. Which is it? Or is it theirs? And that's the world's stuff. And I'm on a different side than that. Different side. I tell you, your neighbors are watching. Your neighbors are watching. And just as an indication, and here's just, this is, and I will repeat, this is a hard topic for me. Because I'll just be honest with you, I'm a fighter. And it's hard not to be. But here's one time I got it right. Last winter, we spent some time in Hawaii. A number of you know that. We were over there for a couple months. And on the way home, one of the things we were trying to do there is line up a cast project. On the way home, we flew home through Oahu, and we went to the Pearl Harbor Museum there, World War II Museum. We walked through there and looked at all that stuff and all that history, fascinating history, and all the stories of people who died in that military engagement, and, you know, the bullet holes in the glass there in those big hangars that the museums were in. And the stuff's pretty real, and here are the planes, and, you know, they're playing videos and glorifying the military strength of the United States. And, you know, walk through that thing, and you got all the way to the end there just before we got ready to eat lunch at the cafe, and one of the last things there in the museum, you know, they had this row of flight simulators set up, screens on the wall, and what the goal was is you could go in there and sit down in one of these things, and you could try your hand at dogfighting, and they'd fly planes at you, and you could see how well you could control these guns and this high power machine, this airplane. I tell you, I like to drive stuff. And when it's legal, I like to drive stuff fast. And I like powerful machines. And I like driving big tractors. I like the power. It feels good. You know what I mean? And you know, that would be fun. Sit down on one of those planes and have all that power and all those guns. Wow. You know, the feeling of strength. And there they were, six or eight of these flight simulators there. And you could try your hand, and, you know, we'd just come out of the museum, and there was a line, and we could do this. And, you know, I got these little boys with me, and the three of them. And, you know, their eyes light up. Whoa. They like power too. And we just saw all this military engagement and this stuff. And, you know, come on, Dad, let's do this. Let's sit down. Come on, let's fly these things. This is going to be fun. You know, and I looked at that and what it represented, and, you know, tourists all around here and how much fun that would be. And Dad, we're going to make a decision here. All the implications. And, you know, I told him, you know, boys, we're just not going to do that. We're not going to. Well, it was a short-lived disappointment for them. We went on. Pretty soon we were over there eating the hamburgers at the stand. And I forget exactly what was said, but I think my wife and daughter were in line yet, maybe, but here some woman walked up to me there afterwards, and I don't want to exaggerate this, but the way memory treats me, you know, she said, you know, I'm a Mennonite too. One of the first things she said, she hadn't, you know, she just saw us there. And I could never have recognized her, you know, cut hair and jewelry, and she's obviously a conference Mennonite. And again, I don't know what the words were said, but the indication was, you know, I saw what you did out there. And I'm non-resistant too. And all these tourists there, you see. And they saw what you did out there. And did the walk match the talk? And when you were training your children, Were you really non-resistant? Were you? And I would just say we have a stand in our home when it comes to electronic games that we don't have games where you fight. We don't fly airplanes and shoot down stuff in video games. We don't play cowboys and Indians and shoot them up. If we're shooting stuff, we're going to be hunting. And when that draft board pulls your app history and they see what you've bought and how many hours you spent on that thing, how are you going to explain it to them when they ask you, are you really non-resistant? Are you really? And I would say the same thing goes to the military air shows and the Blue Angels. And are we really non-resistant? And your neighbors are watching. I would ask the question too, along this line, on this line of suffering and a willingness to do good to others. Is there a softness to your business dealings? Is there a softness? You know, capitalism can be so aggressive and so hard-edged. And money is power. And it is possible for us in our drive to do a good job and to be honest and fair and make a good bargain and make money, that we get into business deals that are compromise our non-resistance. It's so easy. You know, in a world of contracts and agreements and finished dates and electronic transactions, there are incredible amounts of places for misunderstandings or a lack of clarity or a question about performance or many times. And when that comes up, you businessmen, when that comes up, is there a softness to your business dealings that portrays a willingness to suffer? Portrays a willingness, we get all done with this. You know, I can invite you to church and I can feel good about it. And you can take me up on it. And is that what comes through in our, is that our stance as a businessman? And here again, you know, I could tell some personal stories. And this CPA firm in town, and we had an agreement, and an amount of time they were going to work for me, and agreement that what all was mine of the paperwork when we got done, and so then we got done with it, and from my perspective, they didn't give me back what they said they were going to, and I had to recreate a bunch of documents and pay for it again, and I had to start over, and it was a big headache and a hassle for me. And not only that, I got all done with that, and I walked into the office, and I said, now what do I owe you? And I wrote out the check, and we will part in peace. And what do you know, two or three weeks later, I get a bill for another, I don't know, well over $1,000. And am I really... non-resistant. Am I really? And here's the lady running the firm there, and I don't know, I don't think she claims to be a Christian, and what does she think of me? And I'll be honest with you, it was just a bridge too far for me at first, you know, and I sent her back a rather terse email saying, you know what, I don't owe you this money. And never heard a thing back. And I got a statement the next month. And here you owe this money with interest. You know, somewhere in there my conscience started to bother me. You know, and willingness to suffer. And there's a disagreement about who owes what and whether it was fair and what all happened here and who's mad about what. You know, in the end, I just wrote her the check, and there you go. And you know, the next time I see her in town, you know, my conscience will be clear. And you know, I just did what you said. And you know what? What else? Have you heard of Jesus? Because that's why. I just did what you said. And you're ready to suffer. And I had another deal. Something similar. And the other day, I called and left a message on a man. And I'll just call him Mark. I left a message on his phone. And I said, you know, I've got this new project. And will you come help me with this? And lo and behold, it wasn't very long, and he called me back. And when I saw who was calling, you know, there was just some real relief in my heart, because you know, this was not our first conversation. This man, Mark, and Mark is a guy in the community who does work on wells and pumps. And I have a rental property, and I had a crop growing out there, and the pump failed in the crop. And the landlord, you know, I hooked the two together because I got a growing crop and I need water to make this work. And I was kind of the middleman there. And somehow through the whole thing, the work got done, but the bill didn't get paid. And now I'm pumping water, and the landlord's refusing to pay the bill. And I called Mark to begin with, and now Mark's upset, and I get a notice in the mail that Mark is suing the landlord. And you know what? He's suing me too. And all those feelings come up, you know, it's just absolutely unfair. This is not my deal. Why am I in the middle of this? And I went down to Mark and I said, Mark, you know, what can I do to make peace here? What can I do? Is there any way that I can, you know, can I pay you most of it? Can I pay you for your materials? Can we somehow get out of this and feel good at the end? And, you know, we had a pretty good conversation there. But he's going to talk to his lawyer, Mark is. And a substantial amount of money at stake, some $38,000. What am I going to do? So I ask my lawyer, and well, you've got a great case. You know, this ain't your fault. This ain't your deal. This ain't your baby. Why are you, you know, In fact, you ought to sue him back. And am I really non-resistant? You know, that's a lot of money. And what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Well, long story short, I found a way to borrow the money to the landlord to pay Mark. Mark was satisfied, and so now I'm out the money until she comes up with it or sells land or something. And I may never see it. And as a businessman, I'd say probably 50% chance. I wouldn't give you more odds than that I'll ever get it back. But the next time I had a project, and there was a well that I had some question about, and I need some help with a pump, see. And I called Mark, and he called me back, and he's ready to help. If I need help. And is it worth it to me? Is it worth it to me to take that, to have the chance to someday say, Mark, you know what? Have you heard of Jesus? Because you know what? Mark knows it wasn't fair. He knows it wasn't right, and he knows it wasn't my bill. And he knows who got hurt. And so I have a tremendous opportunity to tell him, you know what, Mark? When you're on that draft board and you ask me, are you really non-resistant? Are you really? I tell you, you know what, Mark? You know I am. You be fair with me. You be fair with me. And so I ask, in your business dealings, in an American society driven by the dollar and driven by the performance and the contract and what you said you would do, you know, it is so easy just to line right up with that, and we just march like they march. And in the business world, we've just completely lost our non-resistance. Very soft. The last question I have here is, could you die calmly? Could you die calmly? And I think here to the scripture where it told them that they had not yet resisted unto blood. And here in America, that's us. And I told you the other night, I've done some reading in the Martyr's Mirror recently. And to those of you who would be more than Anabaptist, could you die calmly? And you read the stories of those who they didn't need to be bound to be there on that stake. And they could encourage their young people, yeah, go die. And you could think of yourself as you're marching towards that stake. And in their era, they watched it happen all the time. And so this last-ditch miracle, feeling that we would have, surely something will change here. And it didn't come to pass. And so when they went, they were sure. And they expected to die. And they did. You know, and I'm just impressed with what it must take to really be able to just walk up there and just lay it all down and just die calmly. And if we can't even get cut off in traffic calmly, we don't have a prayer of a chance of dying calmly. You know, I don't know how many of you saw it, but a while ago when that Jordanian pilot was shot down, and ISIS captured him, and they welded him in a steel cage. And it made national news and news the world over, and they welded him in there. This fit young man, pilot in the Jordanian military. He was captured and they welded him in a cave, steel bars, that big around, that far apart, and he couldn't get out. It stood about this high. And I watched a video. It was a video that once you saw it, you can't unsee it. And they dumped gas all over that poor man. And then they laid a stream of gas back a ways, and he's soaked in gasoline or some equivalent. And with the video cameras rolling, they light that torch. And anybody that's burned anything knows how that works. And you just put that the flame down on that strip of gas, and this man is burst into flames. And he's there slapping, trying to get this stuff out. And he just melts and dies. And you know, that was standard fare for an Anabaptist people to watch that happen. And why did they do that? And we're still on foundations tonight, right? They did that because they loved Jesus. And they took this word and says, you know what? I say unto you, that you resist not evil. And you suffer for their good. Because I did. And it was so real to them that they died for it. They died calmly. They died singing. They died glad that they could go to be with Jesus. And the question for us is, are we really non-resistant? Something that's foundational to all the rest of our Christian experience. Foundational to our witness. Foundational to our invitation to Christ. Foundational to the truth of what we are telling our neighbors. If we are waiting for an armed conflict to prove our non-resistance, it'll never work. If non-resistance isn't real in everyday life, it will not be sufficient when put to the test. Should we bow our heads for prayer?